Please pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be acceptable unto you, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Please be seated. I'm going to click this one second. Little meals and little deals. Dinners and banquets. They're not always a party for the people you love, to bring them in and just enjoy your time together. Sometimes meals are status affairs. Power lunches. Charity balls. Awards banquets. Sometimes you walk into the hall and your name is on a card and you have to find out where you're going to sit. Who's going to be at your table? Who do you want at your table? Who would you like to rub elbows with? Sometimes at clergy gatherings, we look at where the bishop is sitting. And there are two responses. We either clamor to sit next to her, or we avoid the table like the plague. Both for reasons are pretty much the same. We care about our appearance. What will people think of us if we sit next to her? What will people think of us if we don't sit next to her? What will people think if she chooses to sit next to me? So, it even happens at clergy lunches, this sense of status, sense of power, this social hierarchy playing out. Meals and deals. This was even more so the case in first century Palestine, first century Rome, under the patron-client system, the patron-client system that everyone breathed. It was a social, political, and economic system, this patron-client system. So the seating at a meal was a pecking order of where you belonged in your relationship with the patron, how worthy you were, and the point was to keep climbing closer and closer to the patron. Where you sat was a statement of how honored you were with the patron, how close you were. And in this ladder of patron-client system, the emperor was on top, and then it just starts going down from there. And every person's fantasy was to keep climbing that ladder. In the patron-client system, the exchange or the transaction is that the client gives the patron honor and status, and the patron, in return, gives financial help and opportunities. So people fantasize about climbing this system, and to the point where those on top are so eager, desirous of those head positions. And you read it throughout Roman history, they would murder in order to get on top. The Jewish system was different. The prophets were constantly rallying the people to pay attention not on the social climb, but on the widows, the orphans, the alien, the lowly. And yet we see today in Luke 14, this little meal, little deal thing going on in the context of a Sabbath meal. A Sabbath meal. So the patron-client system has colonized the mind of the religious leaders. And they are wheeling and dealing on the Sabbath day. The people who had invited Jesus were watching him closely. Besides watching each other and where everyone's going to sit, like, where's Jesus going to sit? Do I want to sit next to Jesus, who has this ambivalent reputation? Do I want to sit next to him? Do I want him to sit next to me? Well, Jesus was watching them. And at one point, he might have said, okay, guys, what are we doing here? Are we Jews or are we Romans? What are we doing here on this Sabbath meal? You're watching this, you're wheeling and dealing. And of course they were. They were doing this patron-client wheeling and dealing thing on the Sabbath day. And they've been doing it for a while. We do not eat the tax collectors and prostitutes. They are the despised. And not only would they come in and bring us dishonor, besides this, we all understand it's not you are what you eat. That is not the adage. The adage is you are who you eat with. And we do not want to be these people. So, Jesus actually reminds them about the teaching of the prophets. Associate with the lowly. Associate with the lowly, meaning not just serve the lowly, that's not it. Be the lowly, because it is true in our society, according to what Jesus' time, you are who you eat with. So Jesus is making that invitation, be the lowly. Eat with the lowly so that you can be the lowly. Why be the lowly? Because in order for you to receive the kingdom, you must be in a place of powerlessness. And the lower you are, the more powerless you are, the greater receptivity you are. And this is why Jesus said, taking up a child, being like this child who has literally nothing to give to you right now, right? But can only receive. Be that lowly. Because it's only when you are that powerless that grace means what it means. Because grace has nothing to do with what you can give God, what you can earn, what you can appear like. So in this context of teaching in this meal, Jesus is not saying invite the poor in so you can serve the poor. Invite the poor in so you can be the poor, because you are who you eat with. In preparing for this sermon, I read James Allison's commentary related to this passage. For those of you who don't know James Allison, he is a theologian, and we had him here a few years ago, and he studies the anthropology of this man named René Girard, who taught at Stanford. And René Girard's anthropology is based on this observation of our ape-like behavior. So apes are very good mimickers. So apes tend to copy and copy and copy. And humans are along this trajectory, and a lot of times we think we're like more evolved than apes. But what the anthropology is actually saying is that we have taken the ape behavior of mimicry on drugs, on heroin. We are hypermimetic. So what does that mean? I see that you've got an iPhone. And I want that iPhone. And then I see someone with a better iPhone, I'm like, well, that's better. I get that iPhone. Whereas before, I might not have even thought about having an iPhone. But I watch my peers, and then I'm like, suddenly I have an appetite for something I didn't even think of. But now I really crave it, and I not only crave it, I want something better. I want to be better than you by having the better iPhone. You might think this is a little intense, but if you've been talking to my niece, she is not convinced that this is, you know, problematic to base her identity on what she can have better than the next. But that is the René Girardian anthropology, is that this intense mimetic, hypermimetic behavior creates in us such a drive that we become rivalrous with one another. And this rivalry will leave us continually feeling anxious and not feeling like we have enough and not feeling like we are enough. And not only that, it makes us very judgmental of people who aren't like us. We often like to poise ourselves in a position of, well, I'm better than them because I do this, I do this, I do this. And it's not even just like having the best car or having the best house. It's like, no, I volunteer more than anybody. I'm better. So even though today we don't have the patron-client system, we have a deep anthropological system of hypermimetic rivalry. And this is the problem when it comes to religion, is that we, because of this behavior, that it's just built in there, we base our worth on things that are not eternal. Like, is my worth in comparison to you, to you, to you? And I caught myself doing this week. I know you've been hearing them turning 50 in 2 weeks for a while now. Obviously, this is an issue for me. Because, you know, when I turn 40, I'm like, oh, well, that's halfway to 80, right? But when you turn 50, that's halfway like, Before, you know, like 10 years ago, I was just like going to be old. Now, 10 years later, I'm going to be dead, right? So I've been reviewing my life a little bit, and I'm like, God, I'm going to be 50. I've never owned anything. look at other people who seem to be like, they've owned houses, and like, they take European vacations, and I'm like, okay, maybe I'll do a staycation, or, you know, it's just, so I'm finding myself comparing myself to what I think are images of success, images of what it means to have made it, and I'm left feeling like I'm not enough. I'm anxious, and this kind of behavior is inherently competitive. And this is what I think a lot of us deal with, to find our worth in something external, in these kind of comparisons. And it takes some effort to kind of calm down the mind. I want to read a little bit of an extended quote from James Allison here, where he describes this thing that I just went through with you. He says this, We as human beings depend absolutely on someone other to give us our sense of worth. That might seem like a huge statement, like, well, I don't. Jesus did say you can only have two masters, right? Mammon or God. This is kind of that what it is. It's like we often think we can determine our master, but actually there are only two. It's either something like peers or something like God, right? So he says this. At root, we all have a profound need that someone should recognize us. And how we act is deeply motivated by our need to obtain this recognition. We all need someone to take note of us and say, I've noticed you. I like you. I like what you're doing. The problem which Jesus raises with his listeners is the same question we have seen in other circumstances, which is, what is the I that I think I am? Does this I depend on, what does it depend on? What is this I that I think I am? And James Allison says there are two possibilities. The I that I think I am is constructed by my observation of my peers and my mimicry of them. So, I mean, it can be something very noble. Like, oh, this person, they're so this, generous, or I'm going to be more like them, right? But what happens in that is this generated rivalry and need for other people to affirm this mimicry. Like, if only someone thanked me. Can someone just thank me for all the good things I'm doing? And we're left seeking out our affirmation from among our peers to say, hey, you're looking good today, you know, doing all this great stuff. But James Allison says, what happens here is that we run the risk of exercising little games of hypocrisy where, he says, perhaps without realizing it, the I is, we find, nothing other than the construction forged by the difficult game of keeping my reputation. So at the bottom, the I that I think of am is actually a construction of the mimic behavior I'm seeing out there. So James Allison says the other possibility is to base the I, the person you are, from God. But then he says this is the problem. This is the problem with our God in Jesus. He has a bad reputation. This guy gets himself crucified. This shameful death. This shameful death. Bottom of the rung. His friends abandon him. Do you want to mimic that? And of course, Jesus goes ahead of us so that we actually don't have to do that. But Jesus places himself in the lowest rung, the most powerless place, so that you don't feel like you got to compete with that, right? Like, that is the lowest rung. So if you were in a low place, all you can understand is what it means to have nothing to offer. Nothing to offer God. Not that polished, beautiful self that you think is worthy to be loved, on the cross all of the reality that we have been thinking makes us who we are gets opened up, and what comes is the floodgate of grace. It's only grace, only love, and you have never, ever had to be more than just standing in its path. And that's it. That is why Jesus says, associate with the lowly, be the lowly, because if you are lowly, then you have nothing to say, oh, well, what about this, what about this, what about this, love this, love this, love this. It's all already accomplished. It is already all there for you. You do not have to mimic anybody when you are at this most receptive place. So Jesus paves the way by putting himself in the most rejected and powerless place. And this is the road he's been walking since chapter 9 of Luke, on the road to Jerusalem, to the cross. And he is saying, when you can follow him and take up your own cross, meaning being in that posture of receptivity and powerlessness, then you are there. You are in the kingdom. And the false self, all this accretion of mimicry, it's just like chaff. It just blows away with the Spirit coming, cleansing you, freeing you, giving you air. No more struggling and striving. Just receiving all this love that has always been there for you. So God was never fooled, and we can leave our own foolishness. And that gaze that we have been looking at ourselves with other people's eyes, that gaze is now only one gaze. And this is why Meister Eckhart got it when he said, At this place, there is the one eye, the eye with which I see God. It's the same eye with which God sees me. No eye, no other eyes, just this one eye. One eye, one knowing, one love.